This is Calvin Hammond in Studio 4 from the Frontline. Tonight's topic, a Macedonian call and miracles in Moreland. 25 years ago, Reverend Canon Kenneth Beringwa of the Episcopal Church of Sudan gave you a Macedonian call by telling you, you must come to Moreland. This challenge led to an extraordinary series of historic events which continue to have positive impact to this day, a quarter of a century later. How did Frontline Fellowship come to be involved in such a faraway, war-torn Sudan, an area that you guys hadn't even worked in before?
Yes, in fact, this is the right time for us to be asking this because just last week, our very good friend, Reverend Canon Kenneth Beringwa, went to be with the Lord. He died in Juba Hospital, Freedom International Hospital in Juba, and his body was transported to the town of Mundri for burial at Christ Cathedral. And it was Reverend Kenneth Beringwa who 25 years ago tracked me down. It was 1994, and the wars in Southern Africa had all come to an end. The Cold War had ended. The Iron Curtain had come down. The Berlin Wall had collapsed. And the Cuban troops had moved out of Angola. Our work was able to look a further field and say, as the wars had ended in Mozambique and Angola, now we could actually look at other places. And the Holocaust in Rwanda broke out. And I was up there ministering, taking Bibles to people in Rwanda, even to prison people guilty of the Interahamwe massacres, the genocide. Saw them getting Bibles, people on death row even. And we were ministering there. And on the way out of Rwanda and Uganda, and I'd just gone to South Sudan, I'd taken in about 250-odd Bibles, but I didn't have a vehicle. I was hitchhiking effectively. And I had come out. I was in neighboring Kenya and Nairobi, and Kenneth Beringwa tracked me down. Now, he was aware of our work on behalf of the persecuted church in Mozambique and Angola, and he's convinced I could be the friend in need they were looking for the Christian suffering in South Sudan.
So you could almost say it was like an SOS call.
Very much. He had written to me. We were in correspondence. I mentioned to him I'm coming to East Africa. I gave him my address that I'd been in Nairobi, our good friends Walter Geschwantner, missionaries to the Muslims, staying with them. And next thing is, he tracked me down, and when he met me, he said with such intensity, "You must come to Moreland." It was like a Macedonian call, and that led to Frontline Fellowship relocating its primary efforts from Mozambique and Angola to Sudan. And Sudan became our most important mission field over the next many years, from 1995 till even now. In fact, it's amazing. In the last 25 years, our mission has taken, according to my calculations, at least 850,000 Bibles and Christian books into Sudan. And it all started with Kenneth Beringwa. So it was amazing. What he explained to me was gripping. I thought I was well informed. I thought I knew what was going on. I was on a mailing list of about 70 different ministries and missions. And I got a lot of newsletters and magazines. I did not know what he was telling me. He was telling me the church in Sudan had been bombed by the Sudan Air Force. Arab forces are waging a scorched earth campaign. They're burning crops. They're destroying livestock. They're looting. Pastors are being executed, even crucified on occasion. The Christians in South Sudan had no Bibles and no medicines. Their children are growing up without schools, and their communities were in desperate need.
Okay. And working together in the war zone, it was him who started the Sudanese People's Liberation Army, or the SPLA.
Well, no, he didn't start them, but he brought to me the first chaplains from the SPLA to be trained as chaplains. So candidates from amongst the Liberation Force. Now, this is interesting because Sudanese People's Liberation Army started out as a pretty Marxist group based in Ethiopia, and they had commissars and red stars and all that sort of thing. And it's a liberation movement that was converted to Christianity. As a direct result of Kenneth Beringwa's work and our training of the chaplains in the SPLA abandoned their commissars, abandoned their Red Star, embraced the Christian flag, embraced and accepted chaplains. And we were able to see an entire military movement, the Sudanese People's Liberation Army, or SPLA, turned from a communist to a Christian-orientated force. Of course, that doesn't mean every individual was saved, but the army turned to where there would be prayer parades, chaplains' parades. You'd say, "Let us read and pray," and the people would take off their hats or berets, and we'd pray, we'd read the Bible, and everyone from the commander down, they were all attending there. And I got to interact with the founder of the SPLA, John Garang, Colonel John Garang, and with Commander Salva Kiir, who was second command then, but he's now the president of South Sudan. And it's interesting because when I started talking to them, we're talking about right back in the 90s, they were very negative and skeptical about independence. They said, no, well, there's no way we'll ever get independent. We're just fighting for autonomy. I said, but that won't work because you will always be a minority in an Arab country. The black Christians are majority in the south, but they're a minority in the whole country. And unless you redraw the map, recognizing ethno-linguistic realities and the fact that the people of the south have a different alphabet, different calendar, different religion, different language, different everything, why would you think that you could be part of a centralized Sudan under Sharia law? And they said, well, we're fighting that we can have autonomy, that we don't have to have Sharia law in the south. And I said, unless you have independence, you will always be a minority. You need to redraw the map. You need to be an independent country. And John Garang and Salva Kiir were telling me back 20 years ago that that's not possible. And so isn't it amazing that today Commander Salva Kiir is president of South Sudan, something they said was not possible back then. And it all started with Kenneth Baringa calling us and organizing for us to train a chaplain's corps, the first chaplains for the Sudanese People's Liberation Army.
But it seems like the SPLA and the chaplains weren't the only people you were focusing on, as you were able to deliver hundreds of thousands of Bibles and Christian books into Western Equatoria and restore the Bishop Gwynne Bible College. And you were also able to equip over 100 primary schools and a Christian high school with quality Christian textbooks.
Yes, that actually was most of our work in many ways. So right from the beginning, when we go into any persecuted area, we ask, what do you need? And the biggest question we get over and over is Bibles, Biblia, we need Bibles. And so Bible smuggling, Bible distribution is always the first priority in these areas. The second thing is Bible teaching. So there's no doubt Bible teaching was important. And then their schools, they had no textbooks, so getting textbooks for teachers and getting in notebooks, chalkboards and so on for the students, and restoring some of these schools. So we supplied over 100 primary schools in Moreland and a Christian high school with thousands of great Christian textbooks, outstanding textbooks, really excellent Bible-based books, and hundreds of thousands of Bibles and books. We flew in at first because there's no other way to get in. And later, when the SPLA liberated a whole chunk of area in the south that it was adjacent to Uganda, then we could drive in once we had a direct road in from Uganda into South Sudan. Then we could truck in even more Bibles. So through all of this, Kenneth Baringa was our invaluable guide. He was the translator, the organizer, the enabler. He made things happen. And he organized this first church conference in a forest. Now, their church had just been bombed by helicopter gunships, the church in Kotobi destroyed. And there we arrived to be able to minister there, and the church was wiped out. And there we were standing in ashes with our Christian flags, and they still want a conference. So we met in the forest, and we would have our conferences. Often people would carry their chairs into the forest. We'd gather where they could be not seen by the Sudanese Air Force. And we can safely say it was because of Kenneth Baringa that all of our work in South Sudan, which has been some of the biggest work of our mission and certainly the most expensive part of our mission in the last 25 years, has been helping the church in Sudan, the persecuted church, getting in Bibles, Bible teaching, textbooks for teachers, training chaplains. On every level, it's just been overwhelming for us. I must say that when we went to South Sudan, it looked impossible, because just to get to East Africa, for me to get to Rwanda for that mission back in 95, I needed to cash in my frequent flyer miles to get a free ticket. We didn't have the funds to buy me a single or a return air ticket to Nairobi. And we didn't have means for vehicles or me even catching a bus. I was hitchhiking effectively, going with others' vehicles in order to transport hundreds of miles into Rwanda and South Sudan. And so it was an incredible miracle that as we took this vision on, which was way past the capabilities of our small mission, that we were able to charter aircraft, organize vehicles, even containers of medicines and so on, and to go into Sudan multiple times. I personally led 27 missions into Sudan, some for as long as a month or so at a time, going up to the Nuba Mountains even. And to the States, I think we've done more than 85 separate missions to Sudan and distributed over 850,000 Bibles and Christian books, a container of medicines, an ambulance for the hospital, a whole lot of things. And those are miraculous provisions, because initially there was no funds for us to do this work. So it's a wonderful example of how, where God guides, he provides.
And on top of all of that, the need for medicine and for doctors, and not only spiritual growth, why was this so important in a nation that was under fire?
Well, I was horrified to hear from Kenneth Beringer that they had about 7 million people in the province of Equatoria. That's the southernmost province of Equatoria, of South Sudan, western and eastern Equatoria. About 7 million people, not a single hospital, not a single clinic in the liberated zone. So he said, you need to bring us doctors and so on. And I thought, well, a man's got to know his limitations. And
that's how you started the medical corps.
Yeah, well, yes, we're not that medical. My mother was a nurse. She would have loved her son to be a medical doctor, but all I knew was the four B's of first aid, breathing, bleeding, breaks, and burns, which I'd learned the fire brigade and the army. So I took in the first 50 paramedic bags, fully equipped these first volunteers. And some of these volunteers had some medical background, had been nurses or so on, which was good. But we gave them good medic bags. One of our teams drove up a four-wheel drive ambulance, a Land Rover that we converted to be an ambulance to transport the war wounded to medical care there. And after my initial training of the first 50 medics and getting in a nursing sister with our ministry who was able to help, Miriam Kane, she did an excellent job. Then we got in some doctors. But I knew I had to do more than that. And so what happened was I was thinking, who is the best person to get involved on the medical side? And the one name that came to me is Samaritan's Purse, of Franklin Graham. Because in Rwanda, during my mission to Rwanda, Samaritan's Purse had been the only medical mission working in that devastated country. They had waded into the sewer system of Kigali Hospital. They had extracted vast amounts of body parts blocking the drainage systems. They'd broken up the congealed blood to allow the plumbing to work. They'd restored the hospital to full operation, despite a plague of rats and myriads of flying, crawling insects. And when even the Red Cross and Doctors Without Borders, Médecins Sans Frontières, they had fled the genocide in Rwanda. But Samaritan's Purse was there, the only medical mission operating in a desperately needy country at its time of greatest need. So I'd no doubt Samaritan's Purse, the right group to come to Sudan, where, you know, let's face it, it was at war, it was in civil war. We've been bombed, strafed, rocketed, came under artillery and rocket fire. And so we knew you need a special kind of people to work there. So I wrote to Franklin Graham, head of Samaritan's Purse, requesting his involvement.
He was also the man in the book of The Doctor Comes to Louis, yes?
Well, Franklin Graham's mentioned in the foreword there.
Yeah.
As the man who came to restore Kenneth Fraser's original hospital. That's correct. So Franklin Graham, I wrote to his office and I got a letter back from his secretary saying, sorry, his program's full, SB's overcommitted, not able to take on any new projects. So I'm praying over this. News came, Franklin Graham scheduled to come to Cape Town, South Africa, to conduct an evangelistic crusade at Newlands Cricket Grounds, which my father used to run as head of the Western Province Cricket Union. His office was there. So I eagerly wrote again, requesting an interview with Franklin Graham when he's in Cape Town. Another polite reply back from the secretary. Sorry, but his program's full. So I'm pondering this, and I'm convinced, but this has to be God's timing. I mean, this is just incredible, a synchronicity. Franklin Graham of Samaritan's Purse coming to Cape Town, my town, while we're trying to get him involved in Sudan.
It's like a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity.
I mean, I don't know if I'm coming any other time before since. This was the one time. And it's within a month of me writing to ask if they'd get involved in Sudan. So just extraordinary, synchronicity. So I wrote again requesting an interview. Sorry, program's full. I'm thinking, no, this can't be possible. And while I'm pondering this, a gold embossed envelope's delivered to my desk. And inside's a card on thick cardstock from the mayor of Cape Town, inviting me to a prayer breakfast at City Hall, where the guest of honor would be Franklin Graham. I mean, wow. Praise God. On the day of the prayer breakfast, I made sure I was there early. And parking my motorbike close to the entrance, I walked with my helmet over one arm. I greeted Franklin Graham, said, Mr. Graham, I believe you're also a motorbiker. And he beamed and replied, yes, he was. And he told me about his Harley Davidson. So next I commented, I see that you've been working amongst the Contra resistance fighters in Nicaragua. And he said, yes, I have. And I said, oh, I've been working amongst the resistance fighters in Mozambique and Angola. And I said, I've got one question for you, Mr. Graham. Why is Samaritan's Purse not involved in Sudan? Well, we have been, he said. I said, yes, but that was an Upper Nile, and I know that your experience was frustrating. But you were trusting in the wrong people. Riek Machar's crowd are surrogates of the Muslim government. Mr. Graham looked surprised and said, I did not know that. So I said, Mr. Graham, I know the people you can trust in South Sudan, in Equatoria. I know just the right hospital for Samaritan's Purse to renovate and use as your base of operations at Louis. It was the first hospital ever established in South Sudan by pioneer missionary Dr. Kenneth Fraser. There's no hospital for 7 million people in Free Equatoria. And at this point, a line was beginning to form behind me, and so Mr. Graham had to politely excuse himself to give attention to the other guests who were arriving. But later during the prayer breakfast, he brought his operations manager, Ken Isaacs, to my table and spoke to me. He said, brief him. So at first, Mr. Isaacs was quite close, leaning backwards, arms folded, legs crossed, body language was kind of negative.
He didn't seem convinced.
No, I mean, he's a bit skeptical. I mean, who's this character in Cape Town? But as I showed pictures and maps, he started to lean forward and look intensely and ask penetrating questions. Well, 2 days later, I received a phone call from Ken Isaacs. Franklin's given us the green light. Can you take us in South Sudan in 2 days' time? I was overwhelmed. I mean, I have full programs. I can't just stop things in 2 days. So I said, I need more time then. He said, Peter, you have a green light. Go through the intersection. So I rearranged my schedule, cleared my plate, cancelled everything I was committed to for the next few weeks in Cape Town, head off to Nairobi and led Ken Isaacs and the Samaritan's Purse team, their exploratory team, into Moroland to explore the newly liberated town of Louis. Now, they were on their way to the Congo, where they were determined to set up a base. And they had been distracted to this because of my intervention and Franklin Graham ordering them. So they weren't too happy to be dragged off to Sudan. And they seemed quite irritated after a while by my stories about Reverend Kenneth Fraser, the first doctor who came to Louis, and what he did, and this pioneer missionary. And he planted the first school, the first hospital, the first church. He had the teachers, the pastors, the evangelists drilling every morning. He had a regular PT and, you know, how disciplined he was. And he said, I said, the people in Moroland are so evangelized, so discipled, you could leave your wallet lying on the path by the marketplace and someone would bring it to you and nothing would be missing. So one morning, as we're driving out to explore the newly liberated town hospital at Louis, where they're going to set up the operation I wanted, Ken asked me, hand me a wallet. Whereupon he unceremoniously just threw it out the window of the truck to land on the ground outside the marketplace. The whole American team were roaring with laughter. They'd obviously had enough of my history stories. So it was a full day exploring Louis, and my thoughts were often returning to my wallet lying on the pathway outside the Mundri marketplace.
Wait, so were they doing this to test if it was true?
Yes, okay. Exactly. And maybe to show me up as,
take, you know, the Mickey out of
exaggerating,
you.
Whatever it was. So, now there wasn't much money in my wallet. There were a few cards. There was a couple of notes. There was my ID card as well. But I began to have second thoughts. I began to worry what might happen if somebody from a neighboring tribe comes past. You know, I've got trust in the Moro, but, you know, now I'm really doubting my words. And when we got back that night, no word. But the next morning, Sunday morning, on the way to church, Canon Reuben, the oldest man in the area, he came up to me with two young boys. And he said, is this wallet yours? And sure enough, it was. He said, these two boys found it, and they saw your picture inside and wondered if it was yours, and so brought it to you. I looked inside, nothing was missing. So I looked sideways at Ken Isaacs and his team, and they were just standing there with mouths wide open, in obvious shock, our eyes widened, like, they were impressed.
Mm.
And from that point, it was clear, Samaritan's Purse was going to come back. They were fully committed to establishing a hospital in Moroland. And within just a few weeks, they were back with specialist equipment, renovating, sorting out, painting, hospital established, surgery, operational. It was impressive. I mean, in literally weeks, there it was. I mean, within a month of me talking to Franklin Graham at that prayer breakfast, Samaritan's Purse was in, operational, up and running with this hospital in Louis. Just extraordinary. Now, Ken Isaac said, we're never anywhere for more than 6 months. We never commit to more than 3 months, but we're committing ourselves to 6 months.
But what was their reason for not being so...
Well, because they're an emergency medical relief group. They don't go into build structure. They like scaffolding. They're going quick and moving. So they go for a crisis. You know, there's a famine here, there's a flood there, and so on. So they were coming in because there's a crisis, but their idea was to be out in 6 months. And they said, we're never anywhere more than 6 months. 10 years later, they were still operating in the hospital, and they treated hundreds of thousands of patients, tens of thousands of surgeries, saved who knows how many lives.
What made them change their mindsets and their procedures?
The people in Moreland amazed them, and I think the whole drama. But I said to Ken Isaacs, after about 7 or 8 months after he'd come, and said, Ken, I thought you said you were never going to be anywhere for more than 6 months. And he said, it's your fault. He said, you helped with the videos, the DVDs gone out. He said, we've got over 2.5 million rand designated for this work in Sudan. He said, it's going to take us years to spend that. He said, the interest in this work in Sudan, he said, we've never been anywhere this long, and it'll be years before we can even spend all the designated money in this hospital. Mm. Well, in fact, at the end, because they had other places to go around the world, after being there 10 years running a superb hospital. I mean, if I was sick anywhere in East Africa, that's the hospital I'd want to go to, because it was the best. And but after 10 years, to get out of Sudan, you know what they did? To use the money that they had in the account designated for Sudan, they built hundreds of churches, simple brick church structures with zinc roofs and so on, cross on top. They built 4 churches whose church had been burned out. I mean, virtually every church I've ever ministered in the whole of Sudan has been bombed at least once.
And while all of this was happening, Reverend Canon Kenneth Beringo was around and witnessing all of this.
Yes, in fact, we walked hundreds of kilometers together. We came under artillery bombardment, rocket bombardment, aerial bombardment. We hid in the same trenches together. We slept on the same dirt ground in the bush. We ministered all around. And I'd say none of this would have happened without the Macedonian call of Kenneth Beringo and the integrity of the Christians in Moreland and just his involvement on every level. And he introduced us to not only the first people to train as chaplains or the first candidates for the medics, but he's the one who organized the church conferences. He must have organized hundreds of meetings for us in Sudan. I think I took, just in my 27 missions in Sudan, 1,200 meetings. That's church services, Bible studies, lectures, seminars, workshops, school meetings, chaplain services. So I did at least 1,200 meetings in Sudan. And other of our teams done even more. And your brother-in-law, Hunter, and other of our missionaries like John and Aubrey and Ben and Daniel, they've gone and they've taken in hundreds of thousands more Bibles and books and textbooks now to the Nuba Mountains in central Sudan. So plainly, what Kenneth Beringo started, it's led to a whole range of unexpected consequences, which has really actually changed history for Sudan, because Sudan now is a free and independent country. As of the 9th of July, 2011, South Sudan's an independent country, which not even the leaders of the liberation struggle at the time, Colonel John Garang and Commander Silvergear, not even they believed that was possible when all this began in 25 years
ago. And it's still the youngest country in the world.
Yes, there hasn't been another country declaring independence since. And South Sudan's even recognized worldwide by just about every country on earth. So considering the Sudanese themselves didn't believe it was possible, what an encouragement to those people who are thinking of independence. And, you know, like Brexit in Britain, we've just seen Britain break away from the European Union, political union, just now, this last week. We've seen a lot of interesting developments of people in the Cape moving for Cape independence. There's different groups in Europe moving for independence. And I think it's a great encouragement that South Sudan is now a free and independent country, which just shows that it can happen if there's enough integrity and determination on the ground. And the people of South Sudan won their independence and their freedom, although, of course, now they've got to protect it because the Arab North is still trying to harass them, of course.
And looking back at the past 25 years of your interactions with Reverend Canon Kenneth Beringo, do you think he would be satisfied with everything that's happened, everything you guys have achieved and passing?
We've got a video interview that someone else took more recently up there, and we've put on our Frontline Mission SA.org website, where Kenneth Beringo expresses his overwhelming gratitude to God for what Frontline Fellowship's been able to accomplish and do there. And it's all positive what he says. But I'm sure he, as a dedicated Christian, could not be satisfied with how things are now, because there's so much more still to do. More evangelism, more discipleship, more Bibles and books, the school textbooks. In some cases, some of the schools have gone back to or gone to UNICEF textbooks, which is evolutionism, situation, ethics, and of course the whole sexual agenda, gay agenda, and so on.
How did this infiltrate South Sudan?
Well, sadly, with independence, at independence, the American ex-president Jimmy Carter who acts like an elder father and goes to new countries and tries to talk them into things. So at independence, South Sudan wanted to declare itself a Christian country. And along came old Jimmy Carter, said, no, you can't declare yourself a Christian country. You just come out of a religious country. So you need to be a secular state. No, you can't have a day of prayer. You can't have days of Thanksgiving. No, you can't do. No, you can't open and pray Parliament.
But what was his agenda for that?
Well, he's, of course, a New World Order secular humanist, although he claims to be a Christian. But Jimmy Carter persuaded Silver Keir and others against their better judgment to listen to this elder statesman, previous president of America, and he comes there to try and guide them into the independence process. And we think he did a serious detour. It was not only bad. Many of the Christians felt betrayed that the cross wasn't part of their new national flag, that they, while they did have some Christian words in the national anthem, the parliament didn't open prayer, and they weren't a Christian country. And now the textbooks were being provided by the United Nations with secular humanism, situation ethics, evolutionism, and all these other things. And so many of the Christians were not happy. And I know Kenneth Bringer personally was not happy with some of the political decisions made after independence. He's got to be glad they're free, that they're not suffering the aerial bombardments, artillery barrages, the scorched earth that the Arabs used to do in them. But I'm sure he would be saying, we need to do more. We need reformation. We've got to go back to the Bible. So another very bad decision, I'm sad to say, that was made because of Jimmy Carter's advice, was to make South Sudan one with Riek Machar's group in Upper Nile. Now, Upper Nile could have been a separate country. Equatoria and Bahr el-Ghazal could have been separate countries. But that one country, South Sudan, and there's a blood feud between the Nuer people of Upper Nile under Riek Machar and the Dinka people of Equatoria, particularly under the SPLA and its leader, Commander Silver Keir. And so for some reason, it was persuaded to have a unitary state and make Riek Machar your vice president. Now, Riek Machar is a criminal, and he was a surrogate for the Arabs. It said that he destroyed more crops, did more destruction of livestock, more scorched earth, killed more Dinka than even the Arab government during the war. And so now they've got to have this man as a vice president, and half of their people, the SSIM movement of the Nuer, as presidential guards. Well, it didn't take long for problems to come. So at the first anniversary of independence, 2012, the president, Salva Kiir, to his credit, admitted at the independence celebrations, we've lost $5 billion, $5 billion with a B, lost to corruption, inexplicable loss out of the national budget. I had no idea they had that much money, but there is oil in the south, and so obviously that must be where the money came from. And who was in charge of that? Well, vice president. He was directly responsible for dealing with the oil and the corruption. And so Silver Keir, as president of South Sudan, gave an ultimatum. This money must be returned. Well, the next year, 2013, on the second anniversary of independence, he fired his entire cabinet, his vice president, the whole cabinet, for corruption. And because only 200 million had been recovered of the 5 billion stolen the first year of independence. And at that point, the civil war reopened. Now, I put a lot of that blame on the extremely bad advice of the American ex-president, Jimmy Carter, who advised something that he should have known was not workable. And those of us who worked as missionaries knew it was not workable.
Maybe some of that money went into his pockets.
I don't know that he would personally be corrupt, but he's a liberal, and he had this New World Order centralization idea. So, but there's no doubt it went to Riek Machar's and his people's pockets. So sadly, there's been an on and off again war, civil war in the south. And while that's been happening, Arab North has come in and taken quite a lot of the oil fields of the south. So they're not in an ideal situation. There's been, obviously, corruption has undermined the first few years of independence. So this vast amount still has to be done in terms of Bible teaching, evangelism, biblical worldview, training in God and government, bringing in textbooks for teachers, seeing that children are well-versed in what the Bible teaches in the schools. And so the work in Sudan is hardly finished. We can't say everything is a total success. But if you look at how we were 25 years ago, to now, well, the situation's immeasurably improved. They've got lots of hospitals, lots of medicine, lots of schools, lots of
infrastructure,
many more churches, vast amount of wells have been planted, lots of lives have been saved, and we have taken in hundreds of thousands of Bibles and books and a lot of materials for schools, evangelistic materials, including Bibles and bikes, God's Story VCD kits, Jesus Film Evangelism kits, all kinds of good resources, gospel proclaimers from gospel recordings, vast amounts of World Missionary Press gospel booklets. So we can say, well, a lot of good's been done. Situation's better. We've got more freedom to minister there. We don't need to worry about what was normal at that stage of the aerial bombardments from the Arabs. So the situation is better so that we can look back and say, praise God for what's been accomplished in the last 25 years.
Mm.
But I'd say there's a big challenge of what still needs to be done,
yeah.
which is what Hunter, Aubrey, Ben, John, Daniel are particularly busy with. And you'll see on our Frontline Mission SA.org website the missions to the Nuba Mountains of Sudan film, which takes one into what we're doing now in the Nuba Mountains, this big Bibles and books project. And if people are interested in the actual history that Kenneth Bering was involved in, and he features in the films, one can get the Sudan Hidden Holocaust, terrorism persecution films, which go into great depth, very good documentary films on. And of course, I wrote the book Faith and Defiant Sudan. There's many pictures, chapters that deal with Kenneth Bringer's involvement and what the church in Moreland did and great answers to prayer and miracles. And because Kenneth Bringer pointed out to me the fact that they didn't have their history anymore, and he mentioned to me about the original missionary who pioneered the work there, Dr. Kenneth Fraser, General Dr. Reverend Kenneth Fraser, the first missionary to Equatorial area, the first missionary to Moreland. He and his wife Arlene came and they set up the first church, first hospital, first school, ministering to body, mind, and spirit, trained the teachers, the chaplains, the pastors, evangelists, did a really good work. And I tracked down a book, The Doctor Comes to Louis, in a secondhand bookshop. And because it was published in 1938, there was no copyright problem, so I reprinted it. And we reprinted thousands, took it in, and the people rejoiced and said, you've given us back our history.
Mm.
It gave the story of how 100 years ago, over 100 years ago, in 1920, the gospel came to their area and how they were restored and all that. So that was just another thing which Kenneth Beringer inspired by letting me know about Kenneth Fraser, who is a great inspiration. He entered the mission field because of the example of David Livingstone, and just to see the connections and what's happened to Pastor Dan, I must say it's been exhilarating...
The passing on of the baton.
Very much so.
Mm. And to end this off, what do you think was your most favorite memory with the late Reverend Canon Kenneth Beringer?
I think walking long distances to remote villages and coming to encourage these people who would greet you with such excitement and with such euphoria. You know, first visitor we've had, we haven't had a pastor in years, mass baptisms, vast amounts of people coming to Christ in these areas. And so those early days, we didn't have a vehicle because there was no roadway open. The only way I could get in was to fly in, and then we walked. And so those early days in 95, 96, walking into these areas with Kenneth Bringer, ministering with the most remote people and seeing the excitement of people who had not seen a visitor in years.
Mm.
That was really, really seriously exciting. And to have seen the rebuilding of the church in Cotterby, which had been destroyed by helicopter gunships, they restored it, and we came in while we were rebuilding it, and we showed them Ben-Hur, we showed them Khartoum, we showed them the Jesus film for the workers while people are there volunteering to help build this beautiful wooden and thatched church. And the church service in there, the first church service in this church that had been destroyed by helicopter gunships after we'd rebuilt it, that was probably the most wonderful worship service imaginable.
Mm. Well, we pray that the passing of Mr. Beringer will bring inspiration to future people to take on his legacy.
Yes, indeed. And so if people want to read more, Faith and Defiance Sudan book, you can get that from christianlibertybooks.co.za, and also The Doctor Comes to Louis on the history of the incredible Christians in Moreland. These people of such integrity that you could leave a wallet at the marketplace and nothing would be missing. How did that come about? So that The Doctor Comes to Louis is a great picture of missionary from the last century. The film, The Holocaust in Rwanda, specifically Sudan Ahead in the Holocaust and Terrorism Persecution. Those would be important films to see. And if you go on the Frontline MissionSA.org website, you'll see the tribute to Kenneth Brengwer, and that's also got a link to a video interview with him, so you can hear from him personally some of what was going on in Moreland at that time.
Mm. Well, this is awesome, and I hope that you will be able to access all of these. Thank you so much for tuning in, and God bless.